Hi, and welcome to Prosody, Essential Public Radio's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Shannon Kane, who is this year's recipient of the Drue Hines Literature Prize for her collection of short stories, The Necessity of Certain Behaviors, published by University of Pittsburgh Press. In addition to the Drue Hines Literature Prize, Shannon Kane is the recipient of a Pushcart Prize, the O. Henry Prize, and a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. She is co-editor of Powder, Writing by Women in the Ranks from Vietnam to Iraq. Her work has appeared or is forthcoming in Tin House, Colorado Review, New England Review, American Short Fiction, and Southward, New Writing from Ireland. She's also the fiction editor of Quarry Press, an international press based in Tucson, Arizona. She has taught fiction writing at the University of Arizona and Arizona State University and was the 2011 Picador Guest Professor in Literature at the University of Leipzig. Welcome to Prosody, Shannon.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Glad to have you. So how about we start out with you reading a little bit?
All right. Sounds great. I'll start with a story called I Love Bob. Hillary's father was Bob Barker from the TV game show, but he didn't know this. So at the end of her sophomore year at Coconino Community College, she drove from Flagstaff to Los Angeles to tell him in person. She'd stay for the month of June, long enough to execute her plan. With tips from her job waiting tables at Denny's, she rented a studio apartment in a stick-and-stucco complex in Van Nuys with walls of cardboard and a swimming pool that sparkled. Hillary's mother left a voicemail message. "Why did you go all the way to California?" she yelled. "It's pointless. I told you. He's a jerk." Her mother had been Miss Orange County, 1985. Her career strategy had involved walking Bob Barker's dogs 4 mornings a week and then sleeping with him afterward. By 20, she was pregnant and forced to withdraw from the Miss California pageant. Bob Barker is 82 and still hosting the show. Hillary was the same age her mother was when she got pregnant. She cannot imagine sleeping with someone 40 years older. If it weren't for ruining her body giving birth to Hillary, her mother might have made it all the way to Miss America. I'll skip ahead a little bit to the part where Hillary develops her plan to meet Bob Barker, which is to become invited to come on down to the stage. Here she's doing a little bit of research, watching reruns of the show. She's met a boy named Alex. Hillary told Alex about Bob Barker. That evening they rented Price is Right episodes from a specialty video store on Sunset Boulevard, a handful from each decade, and watched them late into the night. She sat close to her tiny television and studied Bob Barker's face. Bob Barker liked his contestants. This was a man who enjoyed his job. In a show from the 1990s, a young woman in a University of Alaska sweatshirt agonized over an array of products displayed against an orange backdrop: a vacuum cleaner, a trail bike, a Whirlpool side-by-side refrigerator. Bob Barker was so patient with her. This was a man who appreciated humanity. Contestants were desperate to get on stage, to get close to him. Entire families jumped around in matching t-shirts of pink, lime green, neon yellow, bearing messages of admiration for Bob Barker. "You've got to let go of your dignity," Alex observed, frowning. "That's how you get picked." Yes, but Bob made the letting go look benign, even beneficial. Hillary tried to imagine coming to work every day and seeing all those love notes written across the chests of strangers. If she were Bob Barker, she would never grow tired of it. When she made it on stage, Hillary would tell him she was his daughter. She wasn't kidding herself about this plan being wildly unrealistic. She knew there must be better ways to get to him. But this was family. She needed to be there, to see him right up close, no intermediaries. She needed to see his face when he found out. On screen, one of Barker's beauties caressed an avocado green electric range. Touching and not touching, the model's manicured hand brushed the appliance, teased, withdrew. A red head in a micro miniskirt rode the waves of a king-sized waterbed, arching her eyebrows playfully. Bob had a paternal presence, the way he pretended all that cleavage wasn't really there, those bare thighs weren't bare at all. He never looked directly at the women. He got you to believe he had nothing to do with the decision to display all that flesh.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Shannon Kane, winner of the 2011 Drue Hines Literature Prize for her collection of short stories, The Necessity of Certain Behaviors, published by University of Pittsburgh Press. So I have to ask you, for that story, Shannon, how much research did you have to do about Price is Right and Bob Barker?
I grew up on Price is Right, you know, like many people of my generation. Much of it is imprinted in my brain. But I watched some episodes. Yeah, I did some research. I Googled Bob and had some fun learning about his life.
So when you characterize him about this, you know, kind of benevolent, and then he's actually not, kind of in on some kind of joke with his contestants and stuff, like, how do you enter the psychological realm of Bob Barker?
Well, that's the job of the fiction writer, isn't it? We have to occupy the psyche of all of our characters. And show them as much generosity as we can. Bob Barker, I thought, is a complicated character. It's a little bit strange and difficult to write a story about an actual living human being.
One of the things I love about the story as well, and it pops up in a couple other places in the collection, is, and this might be an odd thing to point out, there's lots of things I like about the collection of stories, but the exactness of numbers. And especially because of Price is Right, everything is like, you know, 1398.
Yeah.
And this kind of precision, which I also think is a way that you depict your characters. You know, you seem to notice the smallest details, you know, not the grand scheme. You have a sense of that with your characters, but it's through these really precise details. That's why I was wondering how much you had to be Bob Barker before you could write Bob Barker.
Well, thanks for saying that, because I work really hard on precision. Precision is one of those things that I believe reveals so much. If you demand of every sentence that it be precise and that it say exactly what it means and means what it says and that it's clear, I think so much just falls from that. Once you do that work, the rest of it takes care of itself.
So let's talk about that a little bit more, because I also... after reading the stories, the language is really clear. It is direct. And one of the things as I was reading, I was thinking is, I felt like the language was kind of holding on really tight, but that was reflective of like the characters. You know, they're all kind of holding on tight to something, trying hard not to let go of something or to hold on to something. And so what is the work process when you're working on sentences, that precision? Like, are you peeling things away? Are you kind of digging till you hit something? And what is it? How do you know when you've hit it? That kind of thing. Because you can tell sentences are really important to you.
Yeah, I love the sentence. I'm turned on by the sentence. I love the rhythm and the cadence of prose. I read out loud everything that I write over and over again. I'm very, very concerned with sentences meaning exactly what they say. And it's interesting to hear you say that they sounds like the characters are holding on tight to something. They are, in a certain way, sort of at a desperate point in their lives and trying to maintain control. And it's a challenge to write a character that's sort of on the edge that way without... the prose just overdoing it. So the process involves writing a lot and cutting back and cutting back and cutting back. I write thousands of more words than I ever use in each of these stories, and they've been revised over and over again. Revision is another part of my process.
Yeah, you can, you know, the sentences feel like they're the heart of it, the kernel of it. And I was thinking about that in terms of the control of the language, and also working with characters who I'm sure at times are a little reticent to be talking about their desperate situations.
Yeah.
And so, you know, trying to tease that out of them. So you know, it's kind of this interesting mix too, I think, in the way that you depict them, of kind of external detail and then this kind of internal, you know, just this one kind of button you can see in them that you've pushed that kind of opens up everything.
Yeah, I'm really concerned, very interested in silences in fiction, in what's not being said on the page. I believe there's an energy that happens between the reader and the writer, and it's our job as the writer to sort of find that sweet spot where we're telling just enough for the reader to engage in what's going on. When we tell too much, the reader turns off and feels condescended to or explained to, and I think that's the thing with literature, that we are drawn to it because we can participate in the text. And finding that balance between enough silence and too much is really tricky.
Yeah, I think, and, you know, I talk with my students sometimes and they'll, advocate. They'll say things like, well, film is better because it's quicker. But there's not that co-creation that happens that you're talking about where you actually, you know, kind of decide what the character looks like. And even though the words are there, you hear their voice, you know, it's not, it makes you lean in to the stories. And I felt that way with your stories as opposed to just sitting back and being entertained.
Yeah, thank you. I work really hard at that.
Yeah. How about you read a little bit more?
All righty. Let's see. Speaking of characters sort of living on the edge and misbehaving, I'm very interested in misbehavior. One of my early fiction teachers told me to create messed up characters and put them in messed up situations. And I have used that advice pretty much through all of it. So this is a story called The Steam Room. And I will read from the beginning of it. The Steam Room. Helen was unhappily married to the mayor of their mid-sized American city. Sometimes she pleasured herself in the steam room of the downtown YMCA. A sign posted in the showers named the city statute under which those engaging in sexual behavior of any kind would be prosecuted. It admonished members to think. But yesterday afternoon, hidden in the semi-dark and wrapped in a hot fog, she called up the eyes of Johnny Depp, gazing into hers as his tongue traced perfect slow circles around her lady parts. The overhead light came on in a shocking flash of fluorescence. Two girls in City High School team swimsuits padded barefoot into the steam room and caught Helen deep in the throes of auto arousal. The following morning, as the political aftermath commenced, she was embarrassed more than anything else by the thought of herself slumped in the corner of the steam room, cellulite thighs, flabby midriff, sagging breasts. The newspaper referred to the girls, Jessica Nelson and Harper Lewis, as the victims. But surely they were victimized more by the sight of her old lady body than by what she'd been doing with her hand. So what happens in the story is that as the day progresses, people who are close to Helen, our character, sort of appear and begin to give her these sexual confessions, as if she becomes some sort of receptacle for their secrets. Let me just read a little bit more towards the end. Last semester, the school swim coach came on to Coral, her daughter. He'd been allowed to leave his job quietly, his credentials permanently revoked, in an agreement devised to protect Coral from the intensity of a local news media hungry for scandal involving the city's elite. If it weren't for Coral's feelings, Helen would have backed a public lynching. The creep had so deftly slithered his way into poor Coral's head. He'd had her believing he was in love with her, of all ridiculous things, that she'd begged them not to embarrass him, to let the whole thing go. So they did. And now, 6 months later, the poor kid was burdened by this sin of her mother's. Were it not for Jerome's job, nobody would have cared what Helen did in the steam room, or that yet another swim coach turned out to be a sick predator. Thanks to her husband's narcissistic career choice, her sweet child was enduring high school with sexual scandals bobbing over her head like Pooh's rain cloud. But adoring her father as she did, Coral would keep her misery to herself. Not so Helen. She'd made it shriekingly clear to Jerome that she was sick to death of being held accountable to backroom power mongers, corporate newspaper hawkers, and throngs of adoring, wild-eyed political junkies.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the winner of the 2011 Drew Hines Literature Prize, Shannon Cain, for her collection of short stories, The Necessity of Certain Behaviors, published by University of Pittsburgh Press. So let's talk about these characters a little bit more.
All right.
In one sense, you have such distinct, and they don't seem odd, but when you kind of go through the list of them, you're like, these are just people I've never even thought about before. Right. There's a couple dog walkers in here, which, mm-hmm. you know, we see dog walkers every day, but you don't really think about the internal life of a dog walker. Mm-hmm. There's also, who else do we have? Let me look at my list. We've got a customer service rep who's trying to take on the Nigerian scam artists.
Yes.
And we also have, you know, the one that you read from in the beginning, a young woman who thinks she's Bob Barker's illegitimate daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Where do these characters come from?
Well, everything's autobiographical on some level. I am all these people, and I am none of them. I bring my life experience to the page and try to tell the truth. I think it's the first obligation of the writer to tell the truth.
Sure.
And for me, I'm just mostly interested in people whose truths aren't being told so much.
Yeah. In some other, you know, pieces that I've read throughout the years, it seems like it's kind of the reverse of what you're doing, that we have kind of average people going through extraordinary circumstances where your equation, and it's not, you know, I don't want to say like all the stories are the same, but they seem to be these kind of people that catch your attention almost out of the corner of your eye. And then you look over, but what they're really going through is, for one, a longing for connection, you know, kind of grappling with decisions, sometimes that they haven't even made themselves, that have been made for them.
Right.
And having to kind of live with the fallout of that. So I found that fun.
Yeah. You know, I see them as sort of average people who are just making maybe bad choices or who are confronted with an impossible situation. I'm drawn to the extreme, you know. Mm-hmm. So when I think about, for example, the story about the queer zoo, that's a guy who works in a zoo made up of all homosexual and bisexual and transgender animals. You know, that was sparked by the penguins in the Central Park Zoo. And I thought, how sweet. And gosh, they're all by themselves being gay in the penguin enclosure. And wouldn't it be great if they had a whole zoo to themselves? And that was it. I was, you know, off from that point and had a great, great time with that story.
That's lots of fun. You know, that's another thing in your story is it has to do with place.
Yeah.
Places specific. But I kind of noticed that at some point where the characters have been put under enough kind of situational stress, they then end up in like this unfamiliar place, like an empty alley, or there's one place where it's like a little girl who ends up in a brand new souped up wheelchair, or another woman empties out her apartment that she's lived in for years. Right. So could you talk just a little bit about how you use place,
like other details, I think carries so much possibility for richness. You know, I think the story that deals most with place is the title story, The Necessity of Certain Behaviors, which is an imaginary place. It's a utopia. It's a the kind of utopia where, you know, where I was at the time thinking, this sounds like a pretty good place that I'd like to check this place out. It's a village in the mountains of a undisclosed foreign country where the villagers are entirely non-monogamous and bisexual. There's sort of a culturally mandated way of being in relationship there. And my urban dweller, the protagonist of the story, gets separated from her group of Americans on an ecotourism trek and finds herself in this village and decides she likes it and stays for a while. I had a lot of fun with that village, with that place. And it turns out that focusing on place just opens up character as well.
Sure. I think, you know, it's that just seems true to human nature too, right? That
right.
You end up in a spot that doesn't have that kind of safety of feeling comfortable, and you might even like it, but you have to explore it in a particular kind of way, which means you're going to have to reveal things that if you're just in your own digs, you might not have to do.
Right. And I'm also very interested in road trips. I'm really interested in America. I grew up in the back seat of the station wagon driving across the country with my three brothers and sisters. No seat belts, you know, father drinking behind the wheel. I mean, the whole thing, it was just, it was sort of a typical American
Hello,
experience. Yeah. And these were the days before you had a video screen embedded in the headrest, and it was either a book or the landscape. So I spent a lot of time sort of indulging that inner life, that rich inner life that a lot of writers have, watching the strange shapes of the mountains and the wildflowers blur along the side of the road. And my father always took back roads. I mean, he was a complicated character. And he shows up in this story, as, you know, as everyone in my life often shows up in my stories. but road trips are a big interest for me. I'm really interested in the way America is changing, the interstate system. I've been to every state in the country by car.
Wow.
Except for Hawaii, because you can't drive there.
No, that would be hard.
That would be hard, yes. But my family drove to Alaska one summer from New York, and we just were really expert road trippers.
Well, and I think it does give you, it also gives you a sense of scale. I know I drove to Seattle once from Chicago, just because I wanted to actually figure out how big it was to get
right
there. And that trip, you really only have to, you go on one highway. There are no turns. It's
uh-huh.
You get on the highway in Chicago and you end up in Seattle.
Uh-huh.
But just to see the vastness
yeah.
is, again, I think it starts stirring kind of thoughts in you as a writer, the characters that reflect that.
Yeah, and as an American, too, I feel like it ought to be an American rite of passage to drive across the country. I'm very interested in maps. Speaking of jobs, one of my characters also is a person who works at AAA, who makes those triptychs, which is a job I had, actually.
Wow.
And I got the job in part because in the job interview I said I'm really used to maps. I was the family navigatrix as a little girl. We did take turns at it, but I was always fascinated with the maps.
You were valuable. You should have been in my family car because we were always getting lost.
It's funny, as I'm getting older, my directional sense is getting worse for some reason. I get lost all the time. But when I was a kid, I was really good at it.
I'm about to read a little bit more for us.
Okay, well, I'll read a little bit from Juniper Beach then, which is that road trip story.
Great.
Juniper Beach. Charlie works as an auto travel counselor in the Cranston, Rhode Island branch office of the American Automobile Association. Mostly, her job involves the assembly of triptychs. Charlie's parents are newly dead, their car having run off the road 3 weeks ago outside of Tucson, Arizona. Upon her return to work after their funeral, she began creating triptychs that send AAA members to destinations different than those they requested. There have been complaints. But this week, Charlie rescued a pair of newlyweds from a hackneyed Niagara Falls weekend, sending them instead on an off-season bargain honeymoon in the turret of a renovated French-Canadian chateau overlooking Lake Ontario. Yesterday, a father showed up at her counter, hoping a White Mountains fishing trip would separate his teenage sons from their Xboxes. Charlie saved him from KOA campground monotony and sent him and the boys to a grouping of National Forest log cabins on the Tioga River. The triptych request form now at the top of Charlie's inbox has been completed by Ruth and Jeffrey Leaf, who report that they would like to travel to Orlando. They have reserved a premium campsite at the Disney Fort Wilderness Resort. The brochure Mrs. Leaf attached to the request form, presumably as a caution against Charlie being unable to find Disney World on a map, described the campground's recent improvements, including enlarged paving in many sites. Charlie tosses the brochure into the wastebasket. If Ruth and Jeffrey Leaf carry out their plans, the Leaf children will not, during this vacation, run squealing into the waves of the great and friendly Atlantic. They will not bite into tuna sandwiches gritty with sand. They will not squint into the clear sky and engage in thrilling speculation about Gulf Coast hurricanes. Via highlighter, she diverts the Leaf family to Juniper Beach. At Juniper Beach, oceanside cottages painted in pastel overlook the sea. They are equipped with Formica dinette sets and 1950s iceboxes, only slightly rusted around the edges, and Adirondack chairs on the porch meant for sipping rum mojitos in the slanted evening light, while chicken with jerk sauce roasts on the grill, and pink-skinned kids wreak mischief with water balloons. At Juniper Beach, there are no super smooth roller coasters or $6 hot dogs.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the winner of the 2011 Drew Heinz Literature Prize, Shannon Cain, reading from her collection of stories, The Necessity of Certain Behaviors. I was just reading the introduction that Margaret Atwood wrote for Best American when she edited it in mm-hmm. the probably mid-80s, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
And she was specifically talking about short stories. And she said that she thought short stories were like, a good short story was like a joke or a riddle,
huh.
that it had kind of this mystifying buildup, an unexpected twist,
mm-hmm.
and impeccable timing. And I just wanted to, what do you think about that?
Timing. That's a really wonderful way to think of it. I think of short stories as, you know, something that it tightness is essential in the short story. Every word has got to count. Every sentence has to bear its weight and prove its worth. Mm-hmm. As I said before, when I do revision, I interrogate every sentence to make sure that it's doing what it's supposed to do and that it's not repeating. And I think, yeah, that makes sense, that timing, that is related to timing. And I feel as though the order of a sentence is related to timing, too. It's mm-hmm. always remarkable to me how you can move words around in the sentence. The same words in a different order will turn something mundane into something hilarious.
Right. There's a lot of humor in this collection of stories. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it, and you know, that makes sense that it's like a joke, because a joke is all about timing, right?
Yeah.
You can have something that sounds really funny, but if you say it wrong, it's not going to have
right,
that same
right.
sense.
Right. I'm a terrible joke teller, but I guess I can do it on the page, but
you
don't ask
do
me to tell
page.
A joke in person.
Now, I know you're also working on a novel.
Yes.
So how is that different or the same, or how, you know, how explain that tension between
well,
the two?
Well, I love short stories. They feel like home to me, you know. But I have a novel in me. I have a novel about Tucson that I've been writing for 6 years. And it's very place-based. It's very political. I'm teaching myself how to write a novel, I think. It's taking me a while. I'm learning as I go, and I'm changing as a person and as an artist as I go.
What's changing?
Oh, life changes you.
Sure.
Yeah. And it's also changing my relationship to the city where I grew up. Or I moved there when I was a teenager, and I've been in Tucson for 30-some years, and I have a complicated love-hate relationship with my hometown, as most of us do. And spending so much time writing about it, spending time with that place on the page, has deepened my appreciation for my hometown and also sharpened my criticism of it.
And on a writing level, do the sentences feel different in a novel than they do a story, or no?
Yeah, they do. You can stretch out. You can kind of meander a little bit. The reader is more patient with a long form.
Are you more patient with the sentences?
No, I'm not.
So I was going to say, you seem to have such a strong sense and discipline about the sentence in a story. I'm just wondering if that's an issue when you have to stretch out a little bit.
Yeah, it's totally an issue. Yeah. And the other thing that I'm doing is I've transformed the novel into a performance art project, where I'm creating an oral serialization of the novel by reading it at the Tucson City Council meetings as public testimony every Tuesday.
Wow.
It's called Tucson the Novel, an Experiment in Literature and Civil Discourse. And so I'm sort of hijacking a space meant for democracy and using it as a stage.
That's great.
It's a very political story. The culminating scene is in the Tucson City Council chambers. And I started it 9 months before the shootings happened in Tucson.
Wow.
And when they did happen, it came into very sharp focus for me that civil discourse and literature are intertwined.
Sure. Well, Shannon, thanks for coming to Prosody.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, Ascension Public Radio's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday at 6:30 for Prosody on Essential Public Radio 90.5 FM.